I'd like to take the Daniel outline and summarize from the beginning. You can begin to see, I think, there's the introduction where Nebuchadnezzar besieges Jerusalem, takes the Jewish youths, and Daniel and his friends ask for the exemption on the Gentile food and drink. God blesses Daniel and the friends. So then the actual text begins with chapter 2, verse 1. And so far we've looked at Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the statue and how that rattled him. It was finally revealed, related, rewarded. Then we see Nebuchadnezzar going crazy with his golden image, and he makes an order that everybody has to bow down to it. The three Hebrew children, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, in their Hebrew names, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, are courageous and will not. And then, so they're thrown into the fiery furnace. And if you can just imagine, we live in a constant, I'll say, tension between knowing the Bible's truth and living in our sensory experience. That was a complicated way of saying this, but we know that God lives, that God is for us, that we're saved, that he's given us the power to conquer sin, for instance. But living our life, we say, I can't do it. Heard the old phrase the other days, just somebody was beside me in public, and they said, the devil made me do it. And it reminded me of, who was that, Flip Wilson, always saying that. Anybody remember Flip Wilson? Yeah, okay. All the young people are saying, what? Anyway, the point being that the devil never really can make you do anything. They believed that God could save them even out of a fiery furnace. But right in front of them was a fiery furnace that killed the people that actually took them up to drop them in, you know? If you can imagine being a pilot of the plane and then suddenly being, while you're flying, and being engulfed in fog where you cannot see anything, just the mist forming on your windows. The instruments are telling you where you are, what's going on, but how difficult it is to not depend on what you see, or not being able to depend on what you see. That's our situation. That was their situation. They certainly would have felt this could be the end. They had received no revelation from God. I will send an angel and rescue you out of this. They didn't know. God did. They were thankful for this, but how brave they were, and how rewarded. So the experience taught Nebuchadnezzar a lesson. We come now to the third main point, Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the tree, and the purpose of the decree, the presentation, the portrayal. Daniel now is ready to, he has been called to get this interpretation, and having heard it, God reveals it to him in his heart, and he has a very strong reaction to that truth. Notice in verse 19a, then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, Nebuchadnezzar himself is the one relating the story, writing the story, Daniel chapter 4, written by Nebuchadnezzar. pagan king. God inspiring every word of it, but in an interesting situation. Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for 1 hour, and his thoughts troubled him. The word translated hour means a short period of time. A full 60 minutes, probably not in view here. That would be an extremely awkward pause, standing right in front of the king. We would probably think of the time as a moment. This was a moment that called attention to itself. This is Daniel standing there, shocked, staring, maybe open-mouthed. The king has told the dream. Daniel understood the meaning, but he hesitates to speak because of the terrible thing it says of the king. There's a couple of reasons why he would be terrified to say it. One is, you don't want to say bad things to the king, who just as easily could have your head taken off. But more than that, Daniel had come to care for this king. This was the king who had honored him, had stood by him, had learned a couple of lessons through Daniel and his friends. And Daniel didn't want bad things to happen to him, as none of us should want bad things to happen, even to our enemies. Well, we see the king's encouragement. The king spake and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation thereof trouble thee. Now, the dream itself implied some interesting things. It talks about this great tree, flourishing, wonderful, and then an angelic spirit being says, cut it down, but put brass around it to preserve the stump. Then, changing the way it speaks, seven times will pass over him, now not a tree, but a person. And the fact that Nebuchadnezzar is so troubled about it, I think he's beginning to think, that might be me. So don't let the dream or the interpretation trouble thee. The king reads Daniel's face. We were talking the other day, Brother Jeb and Heidi, that I have difficulty. My reaction part of my brain is connected directly to my face. If somebody says something to me that surprises me, I look surprised. If something makes me upset, I guess I look upset. You know, I think I'm just thinking, and people are saying, "What's wrong?" I'm not sure I want to tell you. But anyway, Daniel. Face was readable. And the hesitation in relating the meaning of the dream to the king, he gives him permission to say the worst. It's okay, Daniel. I want to know, no matter how bad it is. Well, then Daniel's concern, Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, lord here, of course, meaning my master, my sir, as we would say today, the dream be to them that hate thee, and the interpretation of to thine enemies. So we've got the category set now. This is a bad thing concerning the king. Daniel probably genuinely cared for the king. Surely Nebuchadnezzar's enemies were also proud men. They could be judged of God for the same sin. So he's saying, maybe... May what you dreamed about you be turned to your enemies. Then Daniel's interpretation of the tree. He recalls the vision. The tree that thou sawest, which grew and was strong, whose height reached unto the heaven, and the sight thereof to all the earth, wherever you were on earth, you could look up and you see that tree. It was a mountain tree. Whose leaves were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and in it was meat or food for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt, and upon whose branches the fowls of the heaven had their habitation. So a tree that furnished a lot for the earth and for the beasts and birds that lived under it and in it. Now he reveals the meaning. It is thou, O king, that art grown and become strong, for thy greatness is grown and reacheth unto heaven, and thy dominion, your ability to rule, to the end of the earth. The main inhabitable earth was controlled by Nebuchadnezzar. So the first shock to Nebuchadnezzar was that indeed, as perhaps he suspected, that he was given the dream because he was the tree. Then Daniel's interpretation of the angel's commands. Again, he recalls the vision. Make sure everybody's on the same page. Whereas the king saw a watcher and an holy one come down from heaven and saying, hew the tree down, destroy it, yet leave the stump of the roots thereof in the earth. The picture of leaving the roots means you don't destroy the life, you just destroy the connection between the life, the roots, and what the kingdom had been. Even with a band of iron and brass in the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beast of the field till seven times pass over him. So again, he recalls that. And then he reveals the meaning. First, the meaning of the destruction. This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High. So this watcher and holy one is issuing the command given by God, which is, come upon my lord the king, that they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. Now we understand, if you remember the story, how this happened, but be the king for a moment here, and saying, I lose control so much that they actually drive me out of the kingdom, make me live with beasts of the field. And they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over thee, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. So seven times, we talked about this earlier, could mean 7 months, but probably 7 years. Long time to be with the beasts. And the purpose of it all is to teach him who's really in charge, that it is God. We were talking about the tension between what the Hebrew friends saw with the fiery furnace and what they believed. Here, Nebuchadnezzar looked around and said, you know, everything I see tells me I'm in control. God says, not so fast. It is the Most High that ruleth in the kingdom. And he giveth the kingdom. He gives authority to whomsoever he will. The Apostle Paul in Romans 13 says that the powers, the authorities that be, are from God. So we may not have who we wish, but we have who we need from God's point of view. The second shock was that Nebuchadnezzar would be driven from men, and we understand this with an insanity that makes him act as a grazing animal. Today, this form of insanity is called boanthropy. Today, the purpose, again, the purpose of the punishment is not to kill him, but to make Nebuchadnezzar know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will. This is not the same as salvation or even a religious conversion. You know, a thing like Constantine seemed to do, where he made a political choice to change religions. We don't know about Constantine, but we do know that at the time that he wrote this, he was not saved. All right, then the meaning of the preservation. Now we get the little rainbow over the storm here. My wife and I, or my wife, gets so excited about wonderful things, and so she called me away from watching TV. If you can imagine, to see the huge rainbow that we had the other day, And then we had to get the camera out there in the rain. I had to hold the umbrella for it and take pictures of the wonderful rainbow. Here's the rainbow over the storm. And whereas they commanded to leave the stump of the tree roots, thy kingdom shall be sure unto thee, after that thou shalt have known that the heavens do rule. Perhaps the measure of his stubbornness was that it's going to take 7 years of grazing, to really teach that lesson. If there's any consolation to the dream of bad news, it's that God intends to preserve his kingdom to him and him to the kingdom. Now Daniel says, that's what it means. Let me preach a little bit to you. Daniel's counsel to the king. Wherefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable unto thee, and break off thy sins by righteousness. There's the two sides. Do the right thing, do the wrong thing. Stop doing the wrong thing, start doing the right thing. And thine iniquities, break off thine iniquities, by showing mercy to the poor. An interesting thing for the king. Wealthy, powerful people often think of those under them as resources. And so you make the determination in talking to them, what can they do for me? What can they do for my cause? If nothing, get out of my sight. And that was the poor to the kingdom, you see. Mercy to the poor. If it may be a lengthening of thy tranquility, and the word, the King James margin says, or an healing of thine error. So the sin of pride was shown by his sins versus righteousness, and his iniquity versus mercy, showing love to those who were in special need. So Daniel's advice is to break off his sin by doing right things. He advises breaking off his iniquities or perversities by showing mercy to the poor and the needy. As a result, God may postpone the judgment for a time. So the story at this point takes a break. Nebuchadnezzar still writing. We see the performance of the dream, the precise fulfillment. All this came upon the king Nebuchadnezzar. So he says, but did I listen? No. Did I change? Not really. Postponement ends. At the end of 12 months, he, Nebuchadnezzar, walked in or upon the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. The year is now 569 B.C. Prideful boast. The king spake and said, and you ever remember saying something that later you say, oh, I wish I hadn't said that. Nebuchadnezzar writing this can remember it word for word. The king spake and said, is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for, here's the purpose, for the honor of my majesty. The German archaeologist Robert Coldway excavated Babylon from 1899 to 1917. The city was protected by a system of great double walls. The outer one was 17 miles around. Each of the walls was 25 feet thick. There was 40 feet between the two walls. And it had 360 towers 160 feet apart. The towers were watchtowers and offensive towers. 50 temples crowded into the city at this time, probably one for each of 50 gods. Through the center of the city, a great procession street, 70 feet wide, ran for two-thirds of a mile. Along the street, walls were decorated with enameled bricks. I've seen photos. Some of these are still around. And you think of enamel like porcelain. And they have raised figures. These lions are raised, and in many cases, beautiful blue. Enameled bricks showing 120 lions, 575 dragons and bulls arranged in alternate rows. Each animal stood out against a background of uniform blue tinted with powdered lapis lazuli, which is like a precious stone, I think. They powdered it up, put it in the glaze. The northern end of Procession Street began with the Ishtar Gate, one of eight gates through the walls. It was 35 feet high, about 30 feet per story. You're talking about a 3 to 4 story high structure here, and decorated with 557 animals in bright colors against a glazed blue background. At the other end of Procession Street, rising above the city, was the 7-story ziggurat, a stepped pyramid, 288 feet high. This is 28, 29 stories high, hand-built. Called the Citadel of Enmenanki. Try to use that word 2 or 3 times in conversation this week. About 60 million fired bricks were used to construct it. On the top was the Temple of Marduk, containing a solid gold statue of Marduk weighing 52,000 pounds. It's a lot of gold to be poured into a statue. Near the Ishtar Gate was the palace on which Nebuchadnezzar walked. His throne room was 171 by 56 feet. It's a big room. Yellow columns with Ionic capitals, the decorative things at the top of the columns, were crowned with palmettes, stylized palm leaves, linked to each other by garlands of lotus buds. Probably just northeast of the palace was the artificial mountain of the Hanging Gardens. Nebuchadnezzar built this for his wife, Amytis of Media, who missed her lovely mountains. The Hanging Gardens were considered one of the 7 wonders of the ancient world, different from the 7 wonders of the modern world. So this is what he was looking at. And if a man could be excused for pride in doing a good job, he could have been that, and God would have said, yes, you have. But when he says, I did it for the honor of my majesty, that was too much. The proclamation of judgment. While the word was in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken. Think of the change of attitude. This is what I have done, O King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, he's just the little guy down on earth. The kingdom is departed from thee. They shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. And they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and 7 times will pass over thee, until thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, not just in heaven, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. You rule because I let you rule, God says to him. The heavenly voice tells him that the purpose of the trial is to make him know who's in control. And then the punishment for pride. The same hour was the thing fulfilled upon Nebuchadnezzar, and he was driven from men and did eat grass as oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hairs were grown like eagle feathers and his nails like birds' claws. Now, to eat grass as oxen describes the action of eating, not necessarily a strict diet of grass. Grass also can refer to any vegetation. So the king was probably cared for with a supply of good food, but he chose to eat only vegetation. He was also probably kept in a royal garden area for his own protection. Notice that the words feathers and claws are in italics, indicating they're not in the original language. They seem to be implied. His body changed, kind of adapt to living outdoors. What a lesson to the proud king. Raymond Harrison wrote that he observed a man in a British mental institution in 1946 who believed himself to be an animal. He ate nothing but the grass around the institute, carefully avoiding weeds. We know that they're not very tasty. He drank nothing but water. Dr. Harrison examined the man to find a lengthening of his hair, evidently body hair, and a thickening of his fingernails. So not just a story of the Bible, but something that actually happened as well elsewhere. Well, the point of the dream. We see the conclusion of the insanity. And at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and mine understanding returned unto me. There are a couple of ways we can understand this. Some commentators try to make this looking to heaven a sign of Nebuchadnezzar's repentance. This is not what it's saying. He was not sentenced to insanity until he repented. In fact, am I overthinking this, but doesn't the insanity actually preclude repenting? How much under conviction do cows get? If your next thought is, look at that grass, that looks good, you're not troubled over your sin. He was not sentenced to insanity until he repented. He was sentenced to a period of seven times. So now the time was up. Perhaps he often looked at the heavens. Perhaps there was some dim recollection that one time he used to look up and know what those things are. Perhaps he just happened to do so at the moment the time was up. And at that moment, as he happened to be looking up, he regained his reason. It seems to me that has to be the situation because it was a timed situation. We see the commendation of God. This is by Nebuchadnezzar commending God. We see the sovereignty of God spoken. And I bless the Most High. The last words he spoke were blessing himself for being such a great king and builder. The next words out of his mouth, he is blessing the Most High God. And I bless the Most High, and I praised and honored him that liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. Every king has to give up his rule when he dies. Not so God. Nebuchadnezzar blesses, praises, and honors Jehovah God. Nothing is said about him converting to the sole worship of Jehovah. And as we've already mentioned earlier, he speaks of Daniel as Belteshazzar, named after Nebuchadnezzar's god, Bel. So he was still honoring him. But he had learned this important lesson, that Daniel's God is the one who sets things up or not. Submission of man. A great statement for us to understand. And when we understand, this comes from the mouth of the perhaps most powerful king, potentially most powerful king in the world at the time. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. You compare them to ruling God, by that estimation, they're nothing. And he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand. His hand moves to strike, nobody can stop it. Or say unto him, what doest thou? Nobody can stop him with physical power or by words. This God can do anything he chooses. And Nebuchadnezzar has been convinced of this. He was given a warning a year before it happened, and then reminded by the very words at the time that it happened. Well, the consequences of the dream, We see that the king's reason returned. At the same time, my reason returned unto me. I have wondered about this because if the time was up and the first words out of his mouth were something other than these, perhaps things would have changed. Things would have been different. But because it was as it was, at the same time my reason returned unto me. Then the king's royalty returned. How powerful a man was he that for 7 years he's out eating grass or carefully picked organic spinach. I don't know what they had for him out there, but, you know. And nobody stepped up and said, you know, it's just time to pick a new king. For the glory of my kingdom, mine honor and brightness returned unto me, and my counselors and my lords sought unto me. Since Daniel was the ranking leader of Babylon and the chief wise man, he probably told the palace that the king would return to his former power after 7 times Passover. Perhaps visitors were told the king was unavailable because he was in the woods eating salad. Can't be bothered right now. The king's respect returned, and I was established in my kingdom. After a pedicure and a shave, the king's reputation increased, and excellent majesty was added unto me. I take this to mean that he learned more than just a prideful lesson here, but the warning that was given by Daniel earlier, the turning from sins. Kings that have all power can do literally anything they want. And ultimate power corrupts ultimately is the phrase. So what he was doing is not specified. I'm thankful for that. But the fact that he was evidently was well known, but nobody's going to call his hand on it. So that might have changed also a heart of compassion for those who are needy. He's been needy for 7 years and was taken care of. So I think what would have added to his majesty? I think his character. God warned me in a dream that brought him through an unthinkable situation. This is the stuff of legend. And now I think he embraced that. He allowed people to understand this. And there was something added to his majesty. The king's recognition increased. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth, and his ways judgment or justice. And those that walk in pride, he is able to abase. The purpose of the trial had succeeded, since he now knows that Jehovah is more powerful than he is. And again, we said before, this is the king that conquered Jerusalem. That was the province of Jehovah God. And the idea being that we are more powerful than you and your God, you see. And God is correcting that attitude by saying, you only can do what I allow you to do. We come then to point D, under the times of the Gentiles, Belshazzar's wicked end. We have jumped now quite a bit of time. We see the king's impious feast, impious, not pious, in chapter 5, verses 1 to 4. Belshazzar, the king. We need to step aside here and understand who this fellow is. This is not Belteshazzar, which was Daniel. This is Belshazzar, another king. Nebuchadnezzar died not long after the events of chapter 4 in 562 BC, after reigning for 43 years. So that was a good long reign. His son, Evil-Merodach, is mentioned in the Bible. What a name, huh? 2 Kings 25 came to pass in the 7th and 30th year of the captivity of Jehoiachin, king of Judah, the 12th month, 7th, 20th day of the month, that Evil-Merodach, king of Babylon, in the year that he began to reign, did lift up the head of Jehoiachin, king of Judah, out of prison. And he spake kindly to him, spake good things with him, and set his throne above the throne of the kings that were with him in Babylon, and changed his prison garments, and he did eat bread continually before him all the days of his life, and his allowance was a continual allowance given him of the king, a daily rate for every day, all the days of his life. The emperor, the situation was that Babylon had a number of kings in prison there in Babylon, and also cared for. The idea of inviting underling kings to your banquet table was something of some pretty great prestige. Up to this time, Jehoiachin, king of Judah, had been in prison. And it was Nebuchadnezzar's son, Evil-Merodach, not being so evil, I guess, who elevated him up out of prison, gave him a nice set of clothes, had him clean up, and made him one of the kings that didn't have to go out laboring, but one of the kings that was actually there and honored and given a daily allowance. He's mentioned again in Jeremiah 52. It came to pass the 7th and 30th day of the captivity of Jehoiachin, king of Judah, in the 12th month, 5th and 20th day of the month, that Evil-Merodach, king of Babylon, in the first year of his reign, lifted up the head of Jehoiachin, king of Judah. So the same thing described by Jeremiah. So after 37 years of captivity, Jehoiachin is released and given a portion for of food all the days of his life. So his rule, however, was considered arbitrary and licentious. The people under him didn't like him. He was second generation. Nebuchadnezzar was second generation. I say he's third or whatever. But Nebuchadnezzar really had to work for his rule. And Evil-Merodach just inherited it, said, this is mine by right. So after 2 years, his brother-in-law, Nergal-Sharezer, murdered him and took over the kingship. He's also mentioned in the Bible in Jeremiah 39. All the princes of the king of Babylon came in, sat in the middle gate, even Nergal-Sharezer. And he lists all the others. And at the end, verse 13, the list again includes Nergal-Sharezer. And a guy named Rabmag. I like that name, Ragmag. Ragmag. Hi, I'm Rabmag. Rabmag. When he died in 556 BC, after 4 years of rule, his only child, they really love these names, didn't they? Laborosoarkad, also spelled this other way, became king. He was judged to have a depraved disposition and was beaten to death after 9 months of rule by a conspiracy of courtiers who were not so courteous. These are people of the court that said, we can't let this guy, so you come in and beat him to death. The conspiracy chose one of their own, Nabonidus, to become the new king. He reigned for 17 years, 556 to 539 BC. We're going backward in numbers. Until Babylon was defeated by Cyrus the Persian. The official records of Babylon left no room for a king named Belshazzar. Liberal critics of the Bible, considered Daniel 5 then a myth. Because if we don't know it, it can't be true, isn't it? Isn't that the way of it? Then more information came to light. Oops. In 1861, H.F. Talbot published a cuneiform tablet found at Ur that contained the name Belshazzar. In 1882, Theophilus Pinches published the Nabonidus Chronicle. It showed that the crown prince, that is the oldest son of Nabonidus, was left in charge when Nabonidus left the capital, which he did frequently. So now not only do we have the name Belshazzar, but we have the connection and why he was ruling. Still more texts were uncovered and translated that had the name Belshazzar in them. He was the son of Nabonidus. Documents show oaths sworn by the life of Nabonidus and Belshazzar, the crown prince. The final blow to liberal unbelief came in 1924 when Sidney Smith of the British Museum published a cuneiform document known as the Persian verse account of Nabonidus. One statement in this document said, when the third year, 553 BC, was about to begin, he, Nabonidus, entrusted the camp to his eldest son, the firstborn, the troops everywhere in the country he ordered under his command. So now you're in charge of the army. He let everything go, entrusted the kingship to him, and himself, he started out for a long journey. It has been supposed that during this period of time, the attacks were beginning by the Medo-Persian Empire, and that Nabonidus says, you know, just thinking about it, it'd be a good time for me to go on vacation far away from here. And my son, you get everything you deserve, and you stay here and keep up the good work. And so he leaves. Well, now we find that they are under attack, but Babylon being what it was, so magnificently surrounded by impenetrable walls, and the fact that they hadn't discovered airplanes yet, you know, stuff like this, they were saying, we don't care. Wait till they run out of food, whatever. We're fine. We're fine. There was a river that ran under the walls, went into the city. It was guarded by some sort of a grate, allowed the water to pass through, but not enemy soldiers. So they had water. They had undoubtedly stockpiled food. So what do you do? Enemies at the gates. You want to show that you don't care? You have a feast. We're having a feast after the service to show that even with the enemies at the gate. No, that's a different thing. He made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. So he may be more nervous than he wanted to let on. He's drinking a lot of wine. It would seem a strange time for a feast. All of Babylon had been conquered by Cyrus the Persian, except for the city of Babylon. This is like the last stand. Nabonidus had taken an army to fight him, but was defeated. Nabonidus escaped to Borsippa on October 10th, 539 BC, but Cyrus arrested him and exiled him to Carmania, never to return to Babylon. Since the city knew of the coming attack, they collected a vast amount of food, had the Euphrates River running through the city. Perhaps this feast was a nervous pep rally to praise and please the false gods for their protection. We've stood a long time. They're not going to get us. We see Belshazzar's disrespect. Up to this point, this is just pagan people being pagan people. Belshazzar, whilst he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father, King James margin here says, or grandfather, this is a word that can mean that, Nebuchadnezzar had taken, the Aramaic brought forth, out of the temple which was in Jerusalem. Now, just to say, when we speak of these vessels as being holy, we don't mean that they acted better than other vessels. What we mean is that they were held separate. they had a separate purpose. Their purpose was for dealing with the things of God alone. So the priest couldn't borrow that because he was having a lawn party. These were restricted to the use of God. That's what it means when they were holy things. This he takes to honor false gods and to drink wine out of them, that the king, his princes, his wives, his concubines might drink therein. We need fancier glasses, he says. While it's not clear whether Nabonidus was in the line of Nebuchadnezzar, his son probably was. Probably Belshazzar's mother was in the line of Nebuchadnezzar. We're going to see this connection in just a little bit. Belshazzar remembered the vessels taken from the temple in Jerusalem, perhaps under the influence of wine, or merely as an irreverent and careless man. He uses the holy vessels as carousing cups. And then Belshazzar's blasphemy. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem. And the king, his princes, his wives, his concubines, drank in them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and stone. That's a lot of gods just for the stuff around you. See? So let it sink in just for a moment that they are taking vessels lovingly, carefully, creatively made for one purpose, and that was to honor the true and living God. They take them as carousing cups, and in the drinking of their wine, they're praising the gods of the elements. Let me take you a little further. The king's witness of miraculous writing, Belshazzar's bizarre vision. In the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand. Not a whole hand, just fingers, and wrote against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. I don't know, was it scratching out the plaster? Was it, you know, dust and stuff falling down? Little fingers up there, I mean big fingers maybe. And writing this mysterious writing. Maybe the fingers made marks, I don't know. But it was over against the candlestick where you could see it, where the light was against the wall, against the plaster, probably a white wall. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Ah! He puts the glass down. Excavations of Nebuchadnezzar's palace reveals a room 56 feet wide, 173 feet long. In the center of a long wall, so you have two shorter walls and two long walls. On one of the long walls, opposite the entrance doors, was a niche with white plaster on the wall. Here the king probably sat at a raised table that he could be seen of the 1,000 lords that were sitting in the main room. So a raised table in a cutout niche area, and it was all white behind it. This was where the light would be brilliant. This is like putting a spotlight before spotlights were invented. If torches lit the room in general, the candlestick behind the king would have given special light to the white plaster. Perhaps others, because he would have been sitting with his back to the wall. It'd be a very unusual thing to be sitting as a king with your face to the wall. So back to the wall, looking out, you know, talking to the others, and perhaps others gasped and pointed, causing the king to wonder what's going on. He turns and looks, and he sees fingers writing on the wall. And he's upset. Belshazzar's terror. Then the king's countenance, the Aramaic his brightnesses, was changed. It changed it. And his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints, the bindings or knots of his loins were loosed, and his knees smote one against another. To the heathen, every unexplained thing is an omen from the gods. They live in fear. In the face of the obvious supernatural, man is terrified. Belshazzar's city was surrounded by troops, and now a supernatural omen is before him, doing something very strange, very weird. I have to say, there's a couple of meanings here that this could mean. Is that the joints of his loins were loose so that his knees knocked together. In other words, the muscles of his legs were loose. But the word joints here means bindings or knots of his loins. That could mean that he had been eating and drinking and he just lost it under his toga there. This was scary enough that he lost control of himself. The bindings were loosed. And besides that, his knees were knocking together. Depending on how fat he was, that might have made a noise. I don't know. And then the offer. The king cries aloud. He cries with might to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, the soothsayers. And the king spake and said to the wise men of Babylon, whoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet or purple and have a chain of gold about his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. The reward offers the position of third ruler since Belshazzar himself was only second ruler. He was the only the co-regent. We're going to stop there and look next time at maybe what that writing looked like. And see what God is trying to say at this point. Comments or questions on our lesson today? Some exciting stuff. All right. Well, then let's stand together. We'll be dismissed with a word of prayer. We'll start our service in about 10 minutes. Father, thank you for the opportunity to serve you, to read your word, to read the wonderful things that you did. And at a time with Israel under the domination of Gentile leadership, you wanted to make sure that Israel knew you had not lost power. And you wanted to make sure that the Gentile leaders understood that you were still in power. Father, we call upon you to show the same thing even this day. Help our leaders to recognize that when they go too far in pride and in blasphemy, that you can take them out, take them down, change the rule, change the authority. We ask that you would show yourself strong and encourage the hearts of those of us who look to thee for your help, for being able to lead a life of quiet, peaceful worship. Guide and direct us this day, we pray in Jesus' name.